Pandemic gave us a glimpse of how nature can rebound when we take ourselves out of the equation. And that's all.
Welcome to a Big Sur podcast. This is episode 56. And this time I'm speaking with Maddalena Biarzi. She's the author of an upcoming book being published on April 18. By Heyday Press, and it's called Stranded, Finding Nature in Uncertain Times. And Maddalena opens the book by quoting this stanza. There is pleasure in the pathless woods. There is rapture on the lonely shore. There is society where none intrudes by the deep sea and music in its roar. I love not man the less, but nature more. That's from Lord Byron. So Maddalena is the president and co-founder of Ocean Conservation Society in Marina del Rey, California. And she received a PhD in biology and a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of California in Los Angeles. She has been actively involved in studying the ecology of marine mammals and with a strong conservation bias since 1990. She is the co-author of a book called Beautiful Minds, The Parallel Lives of Great Apes and Dolphins with Harvard University Press from 2008. She is the author of Dolphin Confidential, Confessions of a Field Biologist by Chicago University Press 2012. And now, Stranded, Finding Nature in Uncertain Times by Heyday. Maddalena has experience as photojournalist and television correspondent for Italian TV networks. Her scientific research and books have been covered, among others, by CNN, PRI, Los Angeles Times, The New Scientist, American Scientist, The Huffington Post. She has been a blogger for the National Geographic. And further information on her writing, research, and conservation and outreach efforts can be found at oceanconservation.org. And I got the pleasure of reading a galley copy sent to me from Heyday. And Carl Safina, the author Carl Safina, writes in the foreword that it is ironic that this thing that socially distanced all of us from each other brings us together now to tell the stories of how we coped, how we changed, how we adapted as the world swirled around us, how we stopped going far and started going deeper. I think my conversation with Maddalena will illustrate part of what Maddalena was doing, in fact, was going deeper herself and inviting us to share some of her observations in her immediate neighborhood and by extension, her meditation on how it is that we, all living things, are so beautifully interdependent.
To see what we knew about the marine mammals of Los Angeles, and I realized that we knew little. Dolphins do their own things and don't care about surfers and swimmers. And my mom is from Florence, my dad is from Venice, so consciousness is not something that it's unique of ours. You see that we kind of have to redefine consciousness and open this window of consciousness on for other animals as well. Slow down because he smells the grass and he pees everywhere. So I think if we all act together, we can still change things. You know, I still do have hope.
And it's recording. So let's see. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let
where
me
to start?
Yeah, let me start with before we start talking about your books and your writing life, I want to to talk a little bit about where you are from, because it also is partly, I'm also partly curious because of my own relationship to Umbria, because I think that's where you're from. Can you tell me where in Umbria you're from?
I'm actually not from Umbria. I was born in Verona, and it's northern Italy. And then due to the itinerant nature of my dad's job, we move a lot. So I live in different cities in northern Italy, and then I lived in Rome, and then I moved back to Milan. And my mom is from Florence, my dad is from Venice, so I'm kind of a mix. But now when I go back to Italy, I go back to Umbria because my parents moved there about 15 years ago. And I love Umbria.
Yes. And my wife's family is from Gubbio,
which is very close to my parents' house.
Okay, right. Because that's just a little bit north of Assisi, which, of course, many people are familiar with because of St. Francis.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world, and we traveled there to see her grandmother's, the house in which her grandmother was born, which is kind of amazing. It's not that long ago. And you, of course, are a much more recent immigrant to the United States. Tell me a little bit about what happened. Why did you end up coming to the U.S.?
Well, it's all my husband's fault, I would say.
Okay.
I was studying animals in Italy. I had a project at that time. I was working as a journalist and had a project on sea turtles and dolphins in the Yucatan Peninsula. And I was studying dolphins from boats off the Mediterranean, in the Mediterranean Sea. And my husband, which is actually American, moved to Italy, and we met there, and then he needed to go back to the States. And I could have worked pretty much from anywhere. So I kept my job as a photojournalist. I kept my work in Yucatan and other places as a scientist. And I moved here. So it's totally his fault.
Okay. Was he also involved with marine biology in any way?
Yes, in different ways. When I met him, he was a sailor, so he was sailing in Italy, and that's how we met, through a common friend of us. He was a marine biologist. And then when we moved back here, my husband had all different kind of businesses, and he was very interested in environmental issues. So we, back in 1998, together we founded the Ocean Conservation Society, and he became more and more involved. And he wrote a book about environmental education. And basically, we work, we all do different things as well, but we work on the nonprofit together.
Right, right. Fantastic. It's such an ambitious title for a nonprofit, to save the oceans, considering the incredible vastness of the ocean, which in some ways, also when I read your most recent book in a galley copy, which is soon to be published by Heyday Press, as I understand it. First of all, are we on schedule with publication? Do you know?
Yes, we are perfectly on schedule. The book is supposed to come out April 18th. So Earth Day, pretty much.
Yes, great. So, you know, there are many things, but one of the things that I'm wondering about, I did not, unfortunately, have time to read your Dolphin Confidential or Beautiful Minds, which are two other titles that you have published. Unfortunately, Beautiful Minds is now it's a university press, and it's very expensive to buy, but Dolphin Confidential is still available as a paperback. And one of the things that come up to me when I read your most recent book is, How much of technology have you been using over the years as far as tracking devices? You don't mention it in this latest book, and I'm just curious how much of that you have done and how much of that you implement in your research.
I actually use a lot. I mentioned a little bit of that in Stranded, a little bit more in Dolphin Confidential. But yeah. When I started collecting data, when I was really young, because I've always been so passionate about animals, I was actually using just a piece of paper and a pen and just writing down what I was observing. And I did that for a long time, even when I started studying dolphins at the beginning, when I still didn't know what I was going to do. I was just taking notes and going out in nature, observing what I was interested in, and then taking notes of animals' behavior. And these notes, I use them pretty much for both my research and my writing. But with time, especially when I started my PhD at UCLA and I was doing research off Los Angeles, I needed equipment. And at the beginning, again, I was just writing down notes, and then I started using a computer. Then I designed a database and to collect data in the field. And then I started using cameras to take picture of dolphins to photo identify them. And then I started using video camera to observe interaction about animals. And then I used plankton nets to collect the scale the animals are feeding it on. I use bioacoustic equipment. So what I started with a piece of paper and a pen became a stack of Pelican cases full of equipment, as well as a team of researchers that helped me with my work.
So no radio or GPS installed on individual dolphins?
On dolphins, no. I use the GPS, of course, and all electronic equipment to figure out where the dolphins are and to get their position when I collect data. But I don't tag dolphins. That's not something I do. I mostly study their behavior. I share data, though, with other scientists along the entire California coast. Mm-hmm. And some of these other scientists tag animals or collect samples from animals and so on. So I do different things.
Right. Because, you know, when I have, as I mentioned to you, I think in an email, I have done a lot of ocean voyaging myself for many, many years. So I am very familiar with dolphins. You know, the first time I saw a dolphin was probably in the English Channel, sailing away from Sweden. And then, you know, progressively more and more, and I'm familiar with, just like you are, the phenomenon of leaving and actually entering a harbor, how often dolphins come and just join your boat and start playing around your, especially in the bow or sometimes in the wake. And essentially saying welcome and saying goodbye, it seems like. But then when I think about the vastness of the ocean, sailing from Pango Pango, you know, American Samoa, up to Hawaii, for instance, this is one of those experiences that I had. We're stuck in the doldrums, you know, the area where there is no wind and the ocean is like a huge buckled, I usually call it a huge buckled mirror, which can be especially wonderful at night when you have a reflecting star into that mirror. But in the middle of the day, then no wind at all, not even a ripple on the sea, where, as you well know also, that's the time when you see all the marine life popping in and out of the surface because of the disturbances that animals cause the surface. Yeah. And suddenly we see in a distance a confused sea, and bring out the binoculars, and pretty soon you realize that it is a huge pod of dolphins, maybe 100 or so, 150 maybe even. Right. And they come up and they have an absolute beeline to your boat, which is the only thing present for miles, hundreds of miles perhaps. And they come up and they spend maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes circling the boat and going up and down, jumping out of the water, like as if they are providing for us a little 10-minute show or entertainment. Talk about that a little bit, please, because I've always thought of that, and I'd love to hear your description of that or what is happening.
Yes, I have, going out on the water, I have all kind of experience, including some similar to the one that you describe, spending time with my boat and my researcher out on the water among thousands of common dolphins, for instance. And these dolphins are all around you. And basically the boat goes along and follow this animal where they move, when they move from one feeding ground to the other one, looking for food, sometimes followed by sea lions. And what we tend to forget sometimes, that these animals are as curious of us as we are of them. So they come, they inspect the boat, they look. I take a picture from the bow, and sometimes I see a dolphin turning around and looking at me. And sometimes I have this feeling they are studying me as much as I'm studying them. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful experience. So they are extremely curious about us, about the boat. What I always tell people, though, to be very careful when they go out on the water, how they drive the boat around these animals too, because I push people to go out and observe these animals, these wild animals, in their own environment and not in captivity. And but when you observe them, you also have to respect their space. And often I go out on the boat and I see vessels harassing dolphins or harassing whales. We need to observe them and at the same time respect their space. Even from my boat, unless they come close to me, I always try to maintain a distance from the dolphins. The idea is to observe their behavior without disturbing them. Of course, there is always some disturbance, but I try to minimize that.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, having, again, sailed for many, many, many miles across the open ocean, I can also, you know, these wonderful memories of my 4 and 5 year old son sitting on the bowsprit with his legs, you know, dangling, and always sitting there singing to himself and enjoying the fact that the dolphins are playing just in the bow, just like playing around with the boat, sailing at like 6 or 7 knots, and there they are, easily keeping up with that speed and jumping up and down in front of the boat. There's this wonderful sense of a conscious mind being there playing with you.
And that's something that I also talk in the first book, Beautiful Minds, and again, a little bit also in Stranded, because I talk about all different species and consciousness, and also how these animals are aware of us as much as we're aware of them. And they're really, we have really this parallel lives with dolphins, and more I study them, more I see the similarities between us and them, from taking care of their young to how they live, how they interact with other individual in their let's call it family, even if it's not really the definition that we give of family. Mm-hmm. And so on. The similarities are amazing, and we continue to discover things that we didn't know about this animal every single day, which is make it a very interesting field to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, it sounds, when I read your book and I read about your career,
It is like you're having the most wonderful job that anyone could possibly dream of. Another thing is that when you are studying dolphins that are living off the coast of, in this case, off the coast of Southern California, let's say, I know you've been all over, but let's take that as an example. Those dolphins are living in an environment where there are lots of traffic, lots of rumblings from ships coming in and out of harbor, small craft, motorboats, surfers, all kinds of activity in the ocean, which would mean that those dolphins who live in that region would then adapt to that and be more and perhaps less prone to want to interact with the disturbances, let's call it, or the people activity in the water. And since they're smart and very intelligent, they can probably discern and clearly define various threats and or fun things to play with, let's say, like a sailboat, you know, or a surfer who would be after you've been in the water and hung out together, you'll realize that these are not threats. They're not going to hurt me. And maybe I could just explore and play with them. And the reason I'm mentioning all of that is that a few times, it's not very often that you sail and there is an absolute still and no wind. But when it does happen, when it did happen in my years of sailing, a couple of times it happened that I had dolphins around the boat and I put on my mask and snorkel and slowly descended into the water. Mind you, the boat is laying completely still. There's no wind whatsoever. And I slowly descend into the water. And twice when I did that, the pod of dolphins that were around the boat immediately, like as if they were conscious of my leg and my flippers being something other than the you know, the rudder or something else hanging down off the side of the boat. But as soon as my physical body entered into the water, they immediately disappeared or swam away. What do you think about that? Yeah. What do you think about that?
So I can address a couple of things that you mentioned. First, the avoiding the threats that we are causing and the problem that we are causing to them. I guess the answer to that, in my opinion, is yes or no. So yes, they are able to avoid some of the dangers because these animals are extremely adaptable to the damage we're creating to the environment. But at the same time, also no, because the damage that we are doing to the ocean, it's incredible this time in history. I can start saying some of the problems that we have, from pollution to bycatch, global warming, and especially the cumulative effect of all this problem. And we see the effect of our damage on dolphins, on whales. Even in my backyard here, I can see dolphins with skin lesion and physical deformity. We see in the Mediterranean, there is malnutrition on dolphins. We see all different kind of effects. So they can't avoid our dangers because our dangers to the environment are too big right now. This is something that I talk about. That's one of the main reasons why I write books, not only to make them care about nature, telling them about the beauty that it's not only out on the ocean, but with strength that I'm saying the beauty that it's around all of us that you can experience around you. And it's very important to keep this in mind. And the other things that you addressed was they are aware of your physical presence. Yes, they're absolutely aware of the physical presence. And there are places where they are more friendly dolphins. Dolphins have personalities like we do. So there are areas in the world where are more friendly, are usually this area are like in Australia, where people give fish to dolphins and the dolphins come close to people just to get their fish because it's an easy way to get a meal. But there are also other areas where tend to avoid people. For instance, here I did a study on the interaction between swimmers and kayakers and dolphins. And most of the time, dolphins do their own things and don't care about surfers and swimmers. The bottlenose dolphins, the coastal bottlenose dolphins, they move really close to shore. They move close to shore to find food, moving from one spot to the next. They have their own agenda. They don't care so much about us when they are feeding. So again, leaving them alone and observing them, you can see these dolphins move from one spot to the other one. They move in circle. They feed on the demersal fish, and then they move on. Sometimes, yeah, like to... to play, like you said, there are animals play in the same way we do, and it's playing it extremely important in dolphins. So again, you see different behavior, different personality. But to answer to your question, they are also aware that we are there, and I have many experiences, interesting experience where you really see the dolphins are aware of people. Like, and there are instances where dolphins save humans in distress. So right. I'm not surprised at what you're saying about your leg.
No, it always fascinates me though how extraordinarily conscious they were both those times of, again, that very small part of my body just entering the water. It was like a signal to them as a group to just get out of there. So
because consciousness, what we are learning more and more, consciousness is not something that it's unique of our species. And so is more, you look at animals, and again, not just the dolphins out on the ocean, but the animals that are around you, you see that we kind of have to redefine consciousness and open this window of consciousness on for other animals as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when you look back on Dolphin Confidential, which is, I don't know, how many years ago did you publish that book?
It was published in 2008, and then they made more copy back in 2012. So,
But the 2012 edition does not include any updates or changes.
No, didn't.
Yeah. It leads to my question, though, because you've continued to work in this field since then, and since the publication of that book, and I'm just curious if there are things that you would like to, if you could, or if you got the ambition to do it, change or add to what you wrote in that book?
Well, I think things change continuously, and our knowledge of this animal change continuously. So since I wrote Dolphin Confidential, we learn a lot more about dolphins and how they live in the ocean. Even if we still scratching the surface of what we know, we really know about these animals. But Dolphin Confidential, a little bit like my latest book, Stranded, talks a lot about my life with these animals, my personal experiences as well, and the need to protect them. And that, I think... didn't change. I did have more experiences, some of which I talk about in my new book. But I think it's still, in a way, a current book for what it covered.
Right, right. You say that you have a PhD and a postdoc. It says what in PhD in biology? What was your thesis? Talk about that.
Yes, my PhD is in biology, and I basically studied the marine mammals. That was about the ecology of marine mammals of Los Angeles, because when I moved here from Italy, I was still studying sea turtle and dolphins in Mexico and other parts of the world. And I wasn't really studying dolphins off Los Angeles. And I started sailing with my husband. And I realized the diversity of marine mammals that one can find here, from many different species of dolphins, different species of whales and sea lions, seals, harbor seals. And I was amazed of this biodiversity of animals. And I started looking and I did some research to see what we knew about the marine mammals of Los Angeles. And I realized that we knew little, even considering that these animals are just offshore from the a metropolis like Los Angeles, there are millions and millions of people. We didn't know much these animals. So that's when I started to go out and look up, starting from pretty much zero, who was here, their distribution, their abundance, their frequency in this area. And then my training is as a behavioral ecologist, so I was very interested in their behavior. And that's what how my pretty much my PhD started.
And what does postdoc, what does that mean?
Well, after you get a PhD, you can continue your education, and you can get you can have one or more postdoc on any subjects that you're interested in. My postdoc was a postdoc in education, so I'm very interested in education and educating the public. That's one of the reasons why I write books, and that's one of the reasons why I founded Ocean Conservation Society, because I'm a scientist, but I'm becoming more and more and more conservationist. I don't think we have the luxury to do research without always keeping conservation in mind. Mm-hmm. So all my work is conservation oriented, is to try to protect this species and the environment, and most of all, the environment in which they live.
Mm-hmm. Quick question here. Giovanni Biarzi. Do I pronounce Biarzi correct?
Correct. Yeah, that was
good. Okay, so Giovanni Biarzi, is that your brother?
That's my brother. Yeah, we're a strange family.
Yeah, but he has something called Dolphin Biology and Conservation, a group operating out of Italy. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, my brother is a dolphin biologist like myself. My brother started studying dolphin before, way before me, because I actually started by studying a lizard. My bachelor thesis in Italy was on lizards, and then I went and I studied different species of birds, and then I studied sea turtles, and then I went up the evolutionary scale, and I started studying dolphins and whales as well.
Wow.
But my brother has studied dolphins off the Mediterranean for a really long time. Like me, at the beginning, he was just a scientist, and like me, he became more and more concerned about the status of the environment. So also my brother has a no-profit in Italy. And he also studied dolphins. So now he studied dolphins for a long time. He studied dolphins off of Greece, and now he studied dolphins near Venice, for all places.
Wow!
So he's an environmentalist and a biologist like myself. So that's why we're a weird family.
Okay, he was an inspiration to you then, I guess.
Yes, yeah. And my brother was an inspiration, and my parents were an inspiration, because although we grew up in cities, in different cities in Italy, so I didn't have the possibility to go out and study large mammals like I wanted it, my parents exposed us to nature from an early age. So we are spending our summertime in this beautiful, pristine place in Sardinia, where I was able to look at the small creature of the sand, to snorkel in a sea that at that time was full of life. So those experiences were extremely important with me. And then as a child, I was always fascinated by any creature around me, and that enthusiasm was always kept alive by my parents as well. So I think
I know you were in Orville, yeah, in Sardinia, and I have been. My wife and I spent some time in Calagonone, so just south of there. So I'm familiar with that coast.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I'm kind of scared to go back. I haven't been there since I was a child. I'm kind of scared to go back there and see what happened to that place from my childhood.
Right. But
those memories are very important and very dear to me. And the enthusiasm that I had as a child to discover nature around me is also one of the reasons why I wrote this new book, Stranded, Finding Nature in Uncertain Times.
Right. You know, I spent some time on my island that I grew up in on the east coast of Sweden, near Stockholm, and we were going out with little nets into the boggy areas. This is all freshwater, boggy lake area, where we had these water lizards, we called them. I don't remember now what the name of the actual species were, but there were three different ones. And during the time when they were mating, I think that's what it was. I think the males, if I remember correctly, had a tremendous change of color. So they became really beautifully colored with red and I think even blue and other colors on their bodies. But the reason I'm mentioning it that I did not pursue my interest in lizards because I remember coming home from our excursions to catch lizards, having horrific nightmares of lizards crawling up and coming into my bed from the bottom. So, so I had to kick away the lizards all night long. Anyway, that's a memory I have of my sort of lizard phobia, something you did not suffer from.
No, I didn't suffer from, and that's one of the things I talk about in this book, as Friend and Finding Nature in a Certain Time, is the fear that we have of animals, of spider or lizard or snakes or whatever, comes also from not knowing this animal, not knowing what they are about. You know, we are in our own, we live in our bubble of senses, like Ed Yong wrote in his most recent book, An Immense World, that we tend not to look at how other animals perceive the world. And I think this is really important because any creature around you is extremely fascinating. And one of the things that I point out in the book is that they think, oh, you know, you know this animal, you're studying it because you're a scientist and you have the all the background to do this. You don't need the background. You know, you can go in your backyard and observe the lizards without knowing even anything about them, and you will discover how fascinating these animals are. And there is this animal, they live next to us, and we can learn so much from them, and we can learn to respect them as well while we're watching them. So if you actually start observing lizards and the behavior, how they interact with other individuals, when you look at them, how funny they are when they do the push-up to show the, you know, they're like the Western fence lizard in my backyard, they show their blue abdomen to the other animals on the top of a rock, raising their head to show their territoriality, or when they fight, like they have these wrestling fights. They are extremely fascinating. And I think one of the hope the many hope that I have with these books is to have people open their eyes and look what's around them, because I think that's one of the way that we can reconnect with nature, with the world around us, and I think it's this connection is really important, not only for their survival but for our survival as well, because we depend on nature, we depend on the ocean, we depend on the land, we depend on the animals and the biodiversity.
Yes, yeah, I know you mentioned in the book the it's a fun, it's kind of a fun section when you talk about the lizard, how when there is another, I think it's another male that enters into the territory, and you call it a wrestling match, and that even sometimes they're so intense that blood may be spilled, you said.
Yeah, it's true.
okay, so Stranded, your latest book, is titled Stranded because of the pandemic. So talk a little bit about two things. One is, when you decided to write this book, did you conceive of it in advance, or did it sort of come to you as you started writing it? And who did you think as you were writing it, or who did you hope for being your readers?
So when the pandemic started, I was like everybody else, pretty shocked, but I was kind of lost, because I went from studying animals out on the ocean as a field biologist, always been in the field. I spent most of my life in the field studying animals, to be in my house, pretty much a house arrest, at least for at the beginning. And so I was pretty lost and upset, even if in reality I have no reason to feel that way. I had a lovely husband, a backyard, a house, toilet paper, and everything. It was really shocking. But slowly, I start to reconnect. I had this need of nature that was really intense. And I start to reconnect with the nature that was around me, the one really at my disposal. And by doing so, I discovered the inquisitiveness, the curiosity that I had when I was a child, because I used to study the lizard coming in and out the barbecue, the brick barbecue in my dad's backyard when I was in Italy, or looking at the behavior of my dog, or looking at the tortoise that I kept in a terrarium that I have in my mom's backyard. And I, looking at the animals near me, I found again this childish curiosity. They, in a way, was seemingly lost by studying this. You know, I'm always curious about nature, but I kind of forgot about the magnificent nature that was at my disposal. So I, as I was observing animals, I started writing some essays just for fun, for myself. And then as I was writing, I was thinking, you know, all my neighbors, all the people that live around me, they have to, you know, they have this, they can see these same animals. They can observe the lizard, the bees, the squirrels running up and down the trees, the coyotes. All these animals are here. And I wanted other people to, it's kind of experience the same things I was experiencing, not from the point of view of the scientists, not from I know all these things and I want to learn more, but really with a childish curiosity, really looking what's around you. So that's the reason, the main reason why I wrote this book, to share these experiences that I had in nature, and hopefully to inspire others to better understand and appreciate other species that share the planet with us, and also the wrongdoing that we are doing to for them.
Mm-hmm. And I think not to put words in your mouth, but what it did to me, it was engenders a feeling of sort of hanging out with you in your immediate environment, in your neighborhood, in fact, in your backyard, which I think is one of the most memorable aspects of reading Stranded, is that I got a sense of, again, hanging out with you in your backyard and being invited to the idea of opening up one's eyes and spending time without having anything other than the nature showing itself to you, and that being very much aware of that.
Yes, and I think if something good came from this pandemic, it's really that we learn how to slow down a little, you know, I learn how to slow down and how to reconnect with nature, and also how nature kind of rebound during the pandemic, during this time where we were hiding inside our houses, how nature came out in all different ways. You know, there were animals showing up in cities, like there was a puma coming out in Santiago de Chile. There were more birds in the Venice lagoons. There were a fox showing up in London. So nature. I think the pandemic gave us a glimpse of how nature can rebound when we take ourselves out of the equation. Mm-hmm. And that's also what's given me hope, because if we better understand this connection with nature and to respect nature, nature can come back, even if now we are in a dire situation and we are losing species and biodiversity in general.
Right. Here comes the hard question here, and that is, what do you think is a good writer? What makes a writer good?
I think this is a personal question that is very different for a different type of writer, different type of writing. Mm-hmm. Convey the message that you had in mind. I think it's very important. I don't consider myself a good writer, but when you said that when you read my book, you felt like you were in the backyard with me, that gave me goosebumps, because that's exactly what I wanted. I want a reader to feel like what I was feeling when I was in my backyard. And if I was able to convey even a tiny bit of that, I think it's a great result.
Yes, and you absolutely did. So it worked for me. So I am a fan of your writing, and I think it was, like I said, a very enjoyable, and I learned many things. One thing that is in the back of my mind, or was brought back to the front of my mind, I guess, when I read your book, was also the fact that from a very young age, back in Sweden, where we started talking about the tremendous danger that we were facing as people interacting with the one planet we inhabit. So from then, basically in the early 70s, from then on, there has been a constant message. We're talking now about 50, 60 years of messaging around the danger, around the doom, around the threat, around the extinctions, around the guilt that we should have as human beings for being so bad to our home. And that message has been, I don't know if it's been amplified exactly, but sometimes I feel it has, in step with finding out more. But also at the same time, there have been, if you look for them, messages of hope and progress when it comes to, you know, cleaning up the environment. There are several success stories. And the reason I'm mentioning this is I want you to comment on this. And that is that we now know, and I'm not surprised, because when I went out from a biology class at age 16 or 17 back in Sweden, we generally came out of biology class inspired and happy about learning about this fantastically wonderful world in which we live, and the diversity and the intricacies and the, you know, like you said, everything is in fact of interest, and of, you can be fascinated by every detail of this incredible place we live in. But progressively more and more, every biology class ended with a message of, you have to do something. We are destroying this. We are, the future looks bad. So it has created a situation where many people are now doing social research, where they find that nihilism is growing, you know, which means that life is meaningless. You know, depression and fatalism, which, you know, everything is predetermined, there's nothing I can do anyway. So with those that sort of statement in mind, how do you think of those things?
So you're perfectly right. You know, there is all this doom and gloom because of the situation in which we find ourselves right now, all the destruction we are inflicting to this planet. And there is this sense, it has a name, it's called eco-anxiety. You know, these people can't, even many of my friends can't deal with all this negativity, with all this bad news coming in continuously as a bombardment. But at the same time, I think we need to shake off this sense of negativity, and we need to have hope, and but hope in the sense, really in the sense of action. Hope requires action, and I think anybody can do something to help the environment without feeling hopeless. You know, changes come from individuals. And we all can contribute to change the situation in different way. I found my own way, and it can be writing, be a scientist, trying to share my information with others. But we all have something to contribute to help the planet. And the thing is that I try to explain in the book is that if you do something that is good, even if you start in your neighborhood, even if you say, let's pick up an issue in my neighbor and fix that environmental issue in my neighbor. And I want to do that by not just by myself looking at the computer, but I want to involve other people. And I not only want to involve other people, but then I want to go to my representative and I want to change the situation. And this can grow. And so I think when you do this, when you see that you can change something, you feel better. It makes you feel better, better than, you know, just staying at home and just reading about the bad news and not doing anything about it. Doing something makes you feel better, and also can relieve some of your stress. Also can, so helping the environment, I see it as a positive thing, and they can relieve some of this anxiety that you have, because you really feel like you did something.
Yeah, anxiety when it comes to the environment can also be induced, of course, by the fact that there are many, many different ways of approaching any kind of solution to or reduction of, let's say, the CO2. I mean, we're not going to get into this. This is going to be a very deep and long discussion. But you know how hard it can be if you consciously try to avoid sitting inside your own opinion corridor, but you try to take in information from good science, from very many different sources, how very, very difficult it then becomes to have
You're perfectly right. The problems are huge. We have to deal with the economic and political system that don't want to deal with many of these problems. But that's not a good reason for not doing anything. We have to... each individual have to do something. And I think one of the things that I try to explain in the book is that you can really start close to home. We started this conversation talking about how you see the animals, the dolphins out on the water during your traveling, and how you observe the animal near me, and how observing animals, how looking at other non-human beings living near you can help you to better understand why we need nature and why we need to act. Mm-hmm. And I think if we all act together, we can still change things. You know, I still do have hope. I don't see anything just bad, and I try not to put my head under the sand and say, oh, there is nothing else I can do. I try to do everything I can to change things, and I try to push other people to do the same.
Right, which is wonderful. And then that, of course, is I presume one of the things you wanted to convey with Stranded. So what do you read yourself? What do you recommend to the listeners and to people who are interested in conservation? What do you read yourself, fiction or nonfiction?
I read all kind of things. I read nonfiction I read fiction to relax usually, and I read the nonfiction to learn. I just finished, I'm reading actually right now An Immense World of Ed Yang, which is an amazing book that I suggest to other people. I suggest to everybody to read Carl Safina's book. He's a best-selling author. He wrote the foreword for my book, but he's really an inspiring writer that... really make you care about nature and the surrounding world. Yeah, but I read everything interests me. So I always have a book, actually a pile of book next to me.
I think it's a very common affliction to have more than one book laying around referring back and forth to. So what are you working on now? What are you working on next?
I'm actually working on my next children book. I wrote one that will come out, I think, at the end of 2024 for Macmillan. I think children are our future. So mm-hmm. I think the writing for children is extremely important. And again, try to convey to them why animals are... extremely interesting creature to watch and to learn from. And my book always have this conservation message that I try to give to kids as well. So my last two books are for children.
Okay. Do you feel in good hands with Heyday?
Absolutely. I think I have a great experience with Heyday. It's a non-profit publishing company. It's not a huge publishing company, but that's a good thing because they really care about how the book is produced, how they follow their authors during the process of publishing the book. And I think the final product, I just got a hard copy of the book yesterday. I think the final product, it's really nice. They care about every single aspect of the production and how they communicate with the authors and so far. So I can only say great things about them.
Last question, Maddalena, or actually two questions. One is what did you want to talk about today? When before we started talking, were there any things that you thought, I hope we talk about this.
I think you cover a lot. I think you cover pretty much anything, everything that was important. So I will say no.
Well, okay. So then the last one is, what are you doing now with Heyday, with the book? Are you going to go on a talking tour to bookstores, to schools, or the PR component of the book? What's happening?
Yes, so that's the plan, to try to publicize the book. I will be in Berkeley at the Festival of Books in the beginning of May. I think it's the 6th and 7th of May. I hope to talk to other, give presentations, same thing like I did with Dolphin Confidential, to try not only to publicize the book, but also so to, again, explain why I did this and why I think.
Wonderful. Well, I hope we'll see you. You know, I live here on the coast of California in one of the most beautiful places on earth.
That's an amazing place.
It is. It engenders in people oftentimes a sense that our world is something we should care about. So, I think it's evidenced by how people talk about their visit to Big Sur that they often start asking those kinds of questions. So actually, that's another thing I wanted to maybe ask you to comment on. When it comes to places anywhere where nature is more, let's say, wild and undisturbed, it could be in a park, it could be anywhere. What is it, do you think, within us that makes us, I think intrinsically, just instinctually almost, respond to those experiences by asking deeper questions?
Yeah, I think we are all connected to nature. We just sometimes forget that we are. And going to a park, going to your backyard, observing animals out of the ocean, remind you that with that connection, there is not only a spiritual connection, but it's a physical connection. And it makes you feel better. And even if they're not animals, I bring this example. I wrote a chapter about this in the book about my garden and how I'm not really good at meditation and sitting still. And I'm always moving around. But I needed some relief from this anxiety during the pandemic. And I started gardening. And I went in my backyard and I decided to redo my entire yard, planting endemic plants that require not too much water. So I planted succulents and cacti and things like this. And by doing so, I really started to relax. I really started to feel better. So I did more and more. And now my backyard is full of succulents and holes because I continue to planting. But we really need this connection. And I haven't done this for a really long time. I wasn't even thinking about gardening at all before the pandemic started. And then I realized how much I needed this.
Right. That's why we have in Sweden, you know, again, where I'm from, people have more and more. I don't know actually if it's more and more, but I know of no one that does not have house plants. In other words, plants that they keep alive inside of their homes during the 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, depending on where you are, months of not being able to do anything in any kind of garden outdoors.
Right. And we also reconnect with our pets.
Right.
We realize how important are other animals in our life when we feel isolated.
Yes, you know, I forgot to mention Genghis. Genghis is your dog, your current dog, and So sorry, one more thing. I wanted to ask you, because you talk about taking Genghis with you, but of course, having a dog with you when you are going out on into nature or some park, then having Genghis with you changes your ability to experience fauna, because they oftentimes are very aware of and shy of a dog.
Yes, you're right. I experienced with Genghis, my little, well, not so little actually, because it's half Great Dane, half lab psychic. Right. I experienced nature in a different way, because sometimes it scares the animal that I observe.
Right.
But I also make me discover things that maybe I didn't want to, I wasn't looking at, but I've been with Genghis, you know, make me slow down because he smells the grass and he pees everywhere. So I have to stop when he does that. And while I stop, because he's peeing in a tree, I see the remnants of food of a squirrel. And then I raise my head and I see a tray of a squirrel on the tree. So it's, you experience nature in a different way. And I don't think it's can be a bad way or a good way. It's just a different way.
Right, and better or worse, yeah.
I didn't go out to do research. That's something that I make really clear in the book. I didn't go out in nature with my white coat of a scientist. I really went out in nature in my neighbors as a simple observer, just looking what's around me and right. Trying to discover the little or less little animals, they were all around me.
Thank you so much, Marlena. I think I don't want to take more of your time. And best of luck with Stranded and your next step with the book. And I hope that we will have you come to Big Sur at some point.
I hope so too. Thanks so much for interviewing me. It was great talking to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Say hi to Genghis for me.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Are you still there?
I'm here, actually, yes.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.